It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look at national politics with Harry Enten from 538.com.
First, the environmental group Friends of the Central Sands is calling on the state DNR to continue enforcing regulations on high-capacity water wells in spite of a recent opinion written by the state attorney general, Brad Schimmel.
Schimmel said in an official opinion that a 2011 law limits the authority of state agencies to what is explicitly stated in the law. Based on the attorney general's opinion, that would mean the DNR would not be allowed to consider things like overall environmental impact on a region when granting or rejecting permits to build high-capacity wells.
Bob Clark joins us now. He's the board president of the Wisconsin nonprofit Friends of the Central Sands, which focuses on education and outreach about environmental resources in Wisconsin's Central Sands area. Bob, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Bob, why are you disappointed in the Attorney General's opinion on the DNR's authority over high-capacity wells?
Well, it's a long story, interesting story, that actually spans more than the Central Sands, Veronica. This goes back several years. Lake Beulah Water District in East Troy, actually a landmark case where the DNR did not look at cumulative effects, and the Supreme Court ruled that the DNR really must look at cumulative effects when permitting high-capacity wells. And the key here is an old analogy, if you take one straw and put it in a milkshake, it doesn't have much of an effect. But you add 2, 3, 10, 20 straws, pretty soon that milkshake's going to be gone. And that's really the crux of this issue. The concern that we have is the water levels in the greater Central Sands area, again, not just limited to that, but the DNR's authority to look at and responsibility to look at all of the wells in a given area, not just the impact of one particular well at a time.
So tell us exactly what would change should the DNR decide to follow the Attorney General's opinion.
Well, this has been about a year and a half of sea change, quite frankly. Following the Lake Beulah decision, we actually went to court and prevailed in 2014 with Judge Bolt in looking at a Richfield Dairy case. And it was, again, determined that the DNR does not only have the responsibility, but it also has the authority under the public trust doctrine to look at the wells in this manner. The DNR has pretty much, in a good faith effort, the last several months been beginning to look at that. But the Attorney General's opinion, which is just that, it is an opinion, strips the DNR of anything that's not explicitly written in statute. But frankly, the courts already addressed that particular argument in both cases.
So how much weight does the opinion have, then, if you're saying that you have this legal precedent here of these two previous cases, which say, yes, the DNR should look at that? So which trumps the other?
Well, and that is a very good question. We were astounded, frankly, that the Attorney General would come out with that statement, and thus our letter to the DNR Secretary Stepp. And Clean Wisconsin and other organizations have also prevailed on her to look at case law, look at the history and the impacts, and ignore his opinion, frankly, in this matter.
So if you're looking at how things would be regulated by the books in terms of what the Attorney General is looking for in that opinion, I mean, could you see this as something that is more democratizing, that it might curb the power of bureaucrats, keep it in the hands of the legislature, which is elected by citizens?
Certainly. Let me just make a point. This is not about environmental groups versus agriculture. This really is about protecting the waters of Wisconsin, which are protected under the public trust doctrine of the Constitution. There is no question that I'm a fan of democracy. We have certainly there are bills that are passed that we support and bills that are passed that we do not support. But the reality is, in this case, the courts have prevailed because there is no possible way for a legislative body to anticipate every possible action and reaction in a case such as this. So there has to be some broad implied powers. And if the DNR is not empowered to protect our water, then frankly, who is?
Well, I guess that's a good question. If the DNR is not the one looking at these cumulative effects of the high-capacity wells and how many there might be in an area, who does it fall to look at that sort of science?
Well, there actually isn't anybody else. Therein lies the problem. so the DNR is struggling with what rules should it follow. And the rank and file in DNR are very great people, and they all have the same, you know, general concerns. You know, this is not about, and welcome to Dairy Month, by the way. So it's kind of ironic that we're speaking today, because agriculture and dairy are huge industries in Wisconsin. But so is tourism. Tourism was $19.3 billion in 2015, up a billion from 2014. What happens when the waters begin to erode and lakes begin to dewater? The Little Plover River, south of Stevens Point, has been dewatering virtually every summer for the last dozen years. Other lakes and streams in the area, Fish Lake, Huron Lake, Long Lake, are very much imperiled. When you change the flow of trout streams, you change the temperature, you change the chemical composition, and trout doesn't spawn. What does that all do to the tourism industry of Wisconsin? So it is a big issue. It's not just about one well taking water out of one lake. It affects all of us in Wisconsin.
We're talking with Bob Clark right now, board president of the Wisconsin nonprofit Friends of the Central Sands, talking about regulation of high-capacity water wells. The attorney general has issued an opinion that our guest group is urging the DNR to ignore when it comes to the regulation of high-capacity wells. And you mentioned dairy and agriculture, those industries. As we know, this is a bedrock, Wisconsin is, for agriculture, for the dairy industry. And these high-capacity water wells are sometimes put into place in service of that industry.
Absolutely.
And here we are in a state that has a slow economic comeback, slower than the rest of the country. Is this regulation something that would help Wisconsin spring back more quickly and help those industries in particular?
Well, as a businessman and as a farmers that we've met and spoke to, you know, their concern is certainty, and I agree with that. Businesses need some degree of certainty. At the same time, we're drawing from a resource that literally belongs to everyone of the state. And so it is a balance. It is a balance of certainty for a business model. It is a balance of property rights for individuals that own farmland. But it's also an issue of property rights for those that live around water bodies. So somewhere there has to be this balance. And unfortunately, there's been a proliferation of these new wells over the last many years, and that's what's causing the problem. This wasn't a problem before, but as agricultural land increases, as our production increases, which on the balance sheet may look good, there is a cost to that. There's what's called an externality to those benefits. And that externality, in this case, is dewatered lakes in streams and wetlands that are going dry.
What is your sense of how the state has done at regulating and permitting these high-capacity water wells in the last couple of years?
Well, the last few years have been the real challenge for us, as we see wells being approved without with a stated restriction that they cannot look at more than one well at a time, but an acknowledgement in court, actually, that that's just not good science. It's not backed by science, that we need to look at these cumulative effects. So we're trying to turn back the hand a little bit and provide, again, some balance in doing the math, again, as our good friend George Kraft, professor at UW Stevens Point, says, of what goes in versus what comes out. And right now we have a deficit on what's coming out.
Now, so far, have you heard any response from the DNR?
As of yet, no, we have not.
The head of the DNR is Kathy Steff. She was appointed by Governor Walker, who worked closely with the state's Republican Attorney General, Brad Schimmel. He issued the opinion that we've been talking about. And given that, are you hopeful that your letter will have an impact?
Well, you know, when we started this journey on the well resources 5 years ago, we weren't sure of the impact that we would have. And we have a group of citizens that normally, you know, enjoy their weekends on the dock, normally enjoy their weekends hiking and fishing, who came together and actually prevailed in court. That alone is a story worth retelling. So I think the impact has already been made. It has already been felt. The fact that we're on the show talking about it was something that probably wouldn't have happened 5 years ago if it were not for individuals across the state who are expressing their opinions and expressing their concerns in this matter. So do I expect a decision tomorrow that we reverse everything? Probably not. But I think piece by piece, little by little, differences are being made.
Bob, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Bob Clark, board president of the Wisconsin nonprofit Friends of the Central Sands. His organization urged the DNR to ignore Attorney General Brad Schimmel's official opinion to scale back regulation of high-capacity wells.
Right now, we take a look at the biggest political news in the country and in the presidential race.
Yesterday, presumptive GOP nominee Donald Trump got angry with the media at a news conference where he was challenged on his assertions that he gave millions of dollars to veterans groups.
Political commentator William Kristol has been scouring the Republican base for an independent challenger to Donald Trump, and it looks like he finally found a potential foil to the Trump candidacy.
And we look at the stakes in the California primary coming up next week as Democratic hopefuls Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders vie for delegates in the last big race ahead of the convention.
Joining us now to talk about the latest in political news is Harry Enten. He's senior political writer and analyst at 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
All right, so we got this press conference yesterday. Donald Trump talking to reporters about how much money he'd given to various veterans group. It didn't go like a lot of press conferences do. Let's give a quick listen here.
The press should be ashamed of themselves. And on behalf of the vets, the press should be ashamed of themselves. They are calling me and they are furious because I sent people checks of a lot of money, and we're going to give you the names right now, which is what you want. And instead of being like, thank you very much, Mr. Trump, or Trump did a good job, everyone say, who got it, who got it, who got it? And you make me look very bad. I have never received such bad publicity for doing such a good job.
This is, I mean, politicians and the press, yeah, they clash. This is kind of different territory, isn't it, Harry?
I mean, it's very different territory, just the nasty, vitriolic voice that you hear from Trump. But the fact is that Trump's getting called out because Trump didn't donate the money that he said he was going to donate. He said he raised $6 million. This is back a long time ago that he said at the beginning of the primary season. The Washington Post checked it out, and he had not raised that money, and it was only after they started calling him out that he started writing the checks. So the press is exactly right on this, and I don't think Donald Trump has a leg to stand on, and I think that's part of the reason he's so angry, is he thinks that if he yells loud enough that people will actually think he's telling the truth, when in fact most people, most nonpartisan people, would say he was not.
For a Trump supporter, Donald Trump arguing with the media, they're probably going to be on Trump's side, aren't they?
Well, of course. I mean, look, Donald Trump has, you know, as I've written about, has coalesced the Republican base. He's getting 85% of that vote right now. These people are not going to leave him. The question remains is about that center of the aisle, which doesn't really like either Hillary Clinton nor Donald Trump, and how they view this news. And right now, these are the types of voters who don't tend to tune in until late in the process. And if you're only hearing negative stories about Trump, that's where I would guess that he'd get hurt. But then again, this cycle has been so strange. Who really knows?
You mentioned the Republican vote starting to coalesce around Donald Trump, and there was a lot of talk in the last few months. Well, are Republicans in elected positions and voters alike going to make a stand on principle, say Donald Trump is not one of us, we're not going to vote for him? Polling says no, right? It looks like people are saying, yeah, we're Republicans, we're going to vote for Trump.
Polling shows that those Republicans are falling right in line. What a surprise in this highly polarized age. I mean, look, Trump really pushed all the buttons to almost like an experiment, right? A political science experiment. How far away from Republican core beliefs could you go and still hold on to the Republican base? It turns out that you can, in fact, bash John McCain and Mitt Romney and still be able to maintain 85% of the Republican base. So to me, this whole idea of a never Trump movement has died the death in the general election that it died in the primary.
Were you surprised that it happened as quickly as it seems to have happened?
I think, you know, yeah, it's somewhat surprising given, you know, that, you know, like Paul Ryan hasn't been willing to get behind Trump just quite yet. And obviously Mitt Romney and Jeb Bush are never going to get behind Trump. So I guess it's surprising in that way. But then you look at this highly polarized age that we live in, you know, it's like, who are these Republican voters going to get behind? Hillary Clinton? Yeah, right.
Is this going to hurt the Republican Party? If they're are they buying into everything Trump does and says at this point? This veterans thing, the recent thing where he says the judge in the Trump University case isn't reliable because he's a Mexican, don't let Muslims into the country. Does the Republican Party, in down-ballot elections especially, own these Trump statements now?
Well, you know, that's the real question, right? And we know from the past few election cycles that there's an increasingly strong relationship with how the presidential race goes in a state, and not only how the House race goes, but also the Senate race. So, for instance, you take a look at the state of Wisconsin, and you know that Donald Trump isn't particularly popular in Wisconsin. I believe the closest he's been in any poll to Hillary Clinton in that state is being down 9 percentage points. And not surprisingly, Ron Johnson has trailed Russ Feingold in every poll. And if you go from state to state to state, if Hillary Clinton starts winning races in these states, it wouldn't be surprising that she brings along Democratic senators with her.
Let's talk about a Clinton-Trump matchup looks like, probably the outcome of the primary season here. I know it's early. I know polls at this point don't necessarily tell us that much. That said, what are we seeing in the national polling?
We are seeing that Hillary Clinton, although her lead is certainly diminished from where it was prior to Donald Trump pretty much clinching the Republican nomination by winning in Indiana, she still holds the lead in most of the polls. Since Trump clinched the nomination, she's held an average lead of 2.4 percentage points. And I believe of the 25 or 26 polls that were taken so far, she's led in 21 of them, while Trump has led in just three. So she clearly leads. But remember, polls may be accurate at this time, but they aren't necessarily predictive of the final outcome.
A lot can change between now and then.
Yes, exactly.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com, looking at the latest in the presidential race. Well, the Never Trump movement, you said, pretty much dead, except for editor of the Weekly Standard, William Kristol. He's been an intellectual conservative voice against Donald Trump all along. He's been looking, he has said, online for a GOP challenger. A lot of people are not taking that up. A guy, though, Bill Kristol says, this is my guy, David French. Not a household name. I was not familiar with him. What do we know about this possible outside independent contender?
I mean, I was thinking that maybe Ronald English would be his guy. But the point is that, David French, who is David French? Who has ever heard of David French who's a regular voter? No one. And in fact, I just saw a video in which David French said that he would get behind Donald Trump if he won the nomination. I mean, it was almost the same as if Bill Kristol was looking, couldn't find a guy he actually wanted. Then maybe David French said something. But as I said, the Never Trump movement is not large. It's a very small intellectual movement. So, yeah, maybe David French could get on the ballot in a few states. But, you know, it's going to take a lot of money to get ballot access for a guy like that. And I just can't imagine there being a lot of enthusiasm for a guy that pretty much no one has ever heard of.
Yeah, to get on ballots in a lot of states, you'd probably need someone who can bring a lot of money to the table and a lot of enthusiasm. David French, I guess he writes at the National Review, Iraq war vets are pointed to as his credentials. But again, not a household name, not something that people are instantly going to rally behind.
Let's put it this way. If the National Review had that much power, then Donald Trump wouldn't be the Republican nominee for president. And in fact, he is. It's just very difficult for me to imagine that a movement behind David French could get anywhere for the reasons that you listed versus, say, Gary Johnson, who is the Libertarian Party nominee, is going to be on the ballot in near 50 states. And that, to me, would be a far better vehicle if you want to voice your frustration with both the Democratic and Republican nominee.
Yeah, what's your thinking on that? So he just clinched the nomination for the Libertarian Party. He's got a former Republican governor along with him, too, as a running mate, it looks like, William Weld from Massachusetts. A lot of people, as you pointed out to us many times, not liking either candidate if it's Clinton versus Trump. Is this a year where Libertarians can probably not win, but make a difference in some key races?
Sure. I mean, if you look at the nationwide polling, there have been a number of polls where Gary Johnson has gotten greater than 10% of the vote. At this point, 4 years ago when he ran in 2012, he was only averaging about 2%. He ended up with 1%. So even if, you know, say Gary Johnson got half of that 10%, that would be 5%. That wouldn't only be wide enough to potentially be greater than the difference between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, but it would also guarantee the Libertarian Party federal funding. And you mentioned Bill Weld. Bill Weld has a lot of connections to a lot of big money Northeast men. And it's the type of ticket that when you combine the ballot access with the money that Weld could potentially raise and the super PAC money that supposedly is going to come the Libertarian Party's way, it does seem to me that you could get a fairly strong showing for the Libertarian Party, not winning, but say 3%, 4%, 5%, 6%, 7%, and that could make a difference.
Does that steal votes from Republican Donald Trump, or does it just lure anti-establishment people from both parties and who might not have voted otherwise?
That of course, is the key question, right? If you look back to Ross Perot, for instance, in 1992, even though, you know, he got near 20% of the vote, he was fielding pretty equally from both Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush. If you look at the polling right now, it does seem more that it's a place where voters who are frustrated can place their frustration rather than stealing from Trump or Clinton. But that, of course, can change as the campaign goes on.
Hey, the Democrats still have this primary going on. It's the last big show, California and New Jersey on Tuesday. California, the biggest delegate prize. What are we looking at in the polling going into next Tuesday?
All of the polls have suggested that Hillary Clinton is leading Bernie Sanders. The question is the margin. Is it 2 percentage points as the PPIC poll had it? Is it closer to 20 percentage points as the Survey USA polling has had it? The demographics, it's a state that has a large percentage of Hispanics and a somewhat smaller percentage of African Americans, along with a pretty wealthy white population, does suggest that Hillary Clinton is favored in that state, probably by anywhere from, say, 5 to 10 percentage points. So we expect Clinton to win, be a close state, but remember, as I spoke about last week, given where the superdelegates are and New Jersey happening early on in the evening, I fully expect that the networks are going to declare that Hillary Clinton is the presumptive nominee 2 to 3 hours before the polls in California even close.
And as you pointed out previously, Harry, Democratic primaries are proportional representation. They are not winner take all. So even if Bernie Sanders pulled out a win in either or both state, it just makes up a little bit of his lost ground in the overall delegate count.
Exactly. He's down 270 elected delegates. He's down far more when you combine the elected or what most people call pledged delegates along with the superdelegates. Even if he won California by a point, she'd still clearly have more votes and more delegates than he would. That includes elected delegates. Simply put, unless she is indicted, and even if she is, Hillary Clinton is almost certainly going to be the Democratic nominee for president.
Briefly, as you wrap up, Harry, if that happens, if Hillary Clinton wraps it up, what do you watch for to see if the Bernie Sanders voters consolidate behind Hillary Clinton?
See, look at the polls after she wins the nomination. See if her lead expands like Trump's did after he clinched the nomination. And see what Bernie Sanders does. Does he, in fact, endorse Hillary Clinton or does he hold out?
Harry, thanks as always.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst at 538.com. He joins us every week on Wednesday to talk about the latest in political news. It's no secret that Wisconsin loves its dairy, and today marks the start of National Dairy Month. So we want to hear from you about your favorite kinds of Wisconsin cheese, ice cream, and other dairy products. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us how you're going to celebrate National Dairy Month.
We're joined now by Jeannie Carpenter in the studio, and she's the specialty cheese buyer for Metcalf's Markets. She's also founder of Wisconsin Cheese Originals, an organization that connects consumers and cheesemakers through classes, tours, and events. Jeannie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we're going to start off on this National Dairy Month by talking about dairy in Wisconsin specifically. Tell us a little bit about how Wisconsin did get to be the big dairy state, the big cheesemaker state that it is today.
Sure. Well, I think one thing that a lot of people don't realize is that we weren't always the dairy state. In the 1840s, we have to remember that Wisconsin really was the West. It was that next great virgin land for restless pioneers. So they came here mostly from New York, from the East. They cleared land, they created fields. And by 1860, believe it or not, Wisconsin produced the most wheat in the nation. We produced close to 29 million bushels. But here's something that we know now. When land is not farmed properly, nutrients aren't added back. Nitrogen escapes from the soil. So wheat crops started failing. And then we had this epic wave of the fabulous chinch bug, which we don't hear about anymore.
Wait, the chinch bug?
The chinch bug. It descended upon the Midwest. Like if you've ever read the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, that it makes a play in there. Huh. So it destroyed all the wheat, the livelihood. And the aftermath was really a period of where farmers tried to figure out what to do next.
Really? So this chinch bug came. I have to learn more about this bug. It's so interesting, but we're going to stay focused on cheese. And so farmers had to pivot. They had to find a different way to make money. And so I'm guessing they turned to cheese.
Right. So a gentleman named W.D. Hoard is largely credited with helping organize the dairy industry in Wisconsin along with the university here. He came back to Wisconsin after the Civil War. He settled in Fort Atkinson, and he began his career as a newspaperman. And anyone listening to the show that either grew up on a dairy farm or is on a dairy farm now probably gets the Hordes Dairyman. I grew up on a farm. We got it. It's a pretty legendary publication. And he was one of the authors of what would eventually become known as this Wisconsin idea of dairying. And with the university, he played a central role in educating farmers how to farm sustainably so that they would find stability and regular profits. And in the 1880s, this was a pretty radical idea to educate farmers to get them to know how the soil worked, how the forage grew, and then also what was known then and now as the husbandry of raising cows, taking care of cows so they would give really good milk.
So that was a way to standardize, to share the knowledge across Wisconsin, not just
right.
at the university. So when it comes specifically then to cheese making, what sorts of innovations did Hoard and the university come up with?
Right. So, well, Wisconsin today is still the only state in the nation that requires a Wisconsin cheesemaker's license. We take making cheese extremely seriously here. We have 1,200 licensed cheesemakers. We have 129 dairy plants. That's by far the most in any nation. We have a master cheesemaker program where you can earn your degree after 10 years of making a cheese.
10 years.
So the university here in Madison was really instrumental in setting that bar for education and information, and the bar is still very high, and that's why you see more cheese being made in Wisconsin than anywhere else to this day.
And the name Babcock, I know, crops up. I think of that as the place we go to get ice cream in the summer, but this Babcock has a long history with cheese making, too, it sounds like.
Yeah, so the university here, I mean, across the nation, is probably best known for a gentleman named Stephen Babcock. He created the butterfat test. And in order to make good cheese, the milk coming from cows has to be high in butterfat and high in protein. And before this Babcock test was developed, farmers were all paid the same for their milk because nobody could tell what the components in it were. So if you were a pretty terrible dairy farmer, you got paid the same for your milk as the really good dairy farmer up the road. And so this Babcock test helped, it helped farmers strive to become better dairy farmers, to feed the cows better feed, to get better components in the milk, because the higher the butterfat, the more they got paid. And if anyone has ever grown up on a farm, you know, there's nothing that, you know, gives you motivation than to have your milk check be a little bit higher every week. And we have Stephen Babcock to thank for that.
We're talking with Jeannie Carpenter right now. She is a specialty cheese buyer for Metcalf's Markets and founder of Wisconsin Cheese Originals. And we're talking about National Dairy Month, what Wisconsin, where we came from, our cheese roots, our dairy roots here, how we got there and where we're going. And Jeannie, I want to go back to the cheese licensing program, or how you become a cheesemaker in Wisconsin. How hard is it to become a cheesemaker?
It is pretty strenuous. It is. I think some folks come into cheesemaking with this kind of romantic notion that it's going to be fun and idealistic. And in reality, it takes you between 18 months and 2 years to get your license. You have to take 5 short courses at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You have to apprentice for an already licensed cheesemaker for 240 hours. And then you get to sit for a 2-hour written test. And if you do all that, you get a probationary license.
Wow, you just crushed my cheesemaking dreams.
You have to take it seriously, and it's a serious career choice in the state of Wisconsin.
Right. Well, this has been my backup career. I thought maybe I should just chuck it all and be a cheesemaker, but now I see it's going to be a long road if I do that. Well, you brought along some cheese for us to sample because you are the cheese maestra at Metcalf's. What did you bring?
I brought 2 cheeses, and for the listeners, I apologize, you're not going to get to taste these, but these... These are available. The first, I brought 2 cheeses today that to me really demonstrate how the dairy industry in Wisconsin is growing. You know, we once were really known for commodity cheddar. You know, we made a lot of really big orange cheddar blocks, and cheesemakers are still very, very good at that, but those are fairly low profit cheeses. So what I'm interested in is I'm interested in helping cheesemakers develop cheeses that they can earn more money on per pound, that they can pay the dairy farmers a higher per pound, and that people like me who really like cheese get a really tasty, complex cheese. And to me, there's no better cheese that sort of encapsulates all of that except for Anabasque. And that's what I brought today. It's a sheep's milk cheese by Landmark Creamery. The cheesemakers are Anna Landmark and Anna Thomas Bates, 2 young women who are have just really taken a leap of faith. They know they can make good cheese. They have good distribution. People love their cheese. I don't think they're making any money yet, but that is sort of one of my goals at Metcalfe's, is to try to help young starting cheesemakers who are making really good product to get it into the hands of more consumers.
Right, and that Anabaste cheese is actually one of my favorites. It's at my farmer's market, and what I like about it is that it tastes, it reminds me a little bit of Manchego, which was one of my favorites. It's a Spanish cheese, and it reminds me a little bit of that. It's got a drier texture, it's a little nutty, and it's really good just on a piece of bread or with an apple on it.
Sure. Yeah, so one of the things about specialty and artisan cheeses now is that, I mean, I grew up eating cheese and crackers. You know, you sat down, you watched the Packer game, you ate this loaf of brick or cheddar or Colby, and specialty and artisan cheese isn't really made to be eaten like that. It's meant to be savored a little piece at a time or cooked with. And a lot of folks complain that it's too expensive, but you don't need to eat a half a pound of this cheese to feel satisfied. You really need like two bites. And when a cheese is this expensive, two bites is really all you need to feel really good about it.
So why is this type of cheese more expensive? Is it just more labor intensive?
That's an excellent question. It's almost like I planted you as a person here. So cows give per day, they give about 6 to 10 gallons of milk. Okay, and cow's milk sells for about $15 per 100 pounds. Goats give you about 5 quarts of milk a day, and goat's milk sells for about $36 for 100 pounds. Sheep, the lovely sheep, gives you, if you're super lucky and look at it nicely, 1 to 2 quarts a day. Uh-huh. So that means sheep's milk sells for about $100 per 100 pounds. So when you are making cheese, this sheep milk is like gold. Also, these artisan cheeses are they're handmade, they're labor intensive. So when you combine expensive milk with hand labor, cheeses get a little bit pricier.
Well, we've got a caller now we're going to get to, and we're going to get to your cheddar too in a little bit. But first, let's go to Shannon in Franklin. Shannon, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment. I was living, I'm originally from Wisconsin, then moved to Charlotte, North Carolina for 13 years. And out there, we weren't able to get the, you know, frozen custards, the squeaky cheese, all that kind of stuff. And so recently moving back, I went from a size 2 to a size 12. Because of the indulgence and just the fact that I had gone so long without being able to obtain it. And following up with that, I was talking earlier, there was a major ad campaign. I was an advertising executive out there, and one of them, it was from California. And my question to you is, how come California is now claiming that they are the dairy state compared to Wisconsin? And I can take your comment off air.
All right. Thanks, Shannon. I appreciate that. And yeah, I remember those ads with the cows. They were supposedly the happy cows living in California, and California was, you know, in danger of bumping Wisconsin. Where are we with that?
So California makes more milk than Wisconsin. And I am perfectly happy with that, because the average size of the dairy farm in California is 2,000 cows. The average size of the dairy farm in Wisconsin is 129 cows. 90% of California's milk goes into fluid bottled milk. That is a very low profit product. So I'm super happy to let California be the number one milk state. Wisconsin is the number one cheese state. 90% of our milk goes into cheese. So when we drink fluid milk in Wisconsin, there's actually a pretty good chance it's coming from Illinois, because we are a milk deficit state when it comes to cheese. And as long as I can keep dairy farmers shipping milk to cheesemakers, they will consistently make a higher profit, because getting back to the Babcock, they are getting paid on components. They're getting paid for butterfat and protein. And that's how we've really kept this dairy industry in Wisconsin going strong.
We're starting off National Dairy Month right now with Jeannie Carpenter, founder of Wisconsin Cheese Originals, self-proclaimed cheese geek about what the dairy industry has meant to Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you. How are you going to celebrate National Dairy Month? How has Wisconsin's dairy industry played a role in your life? Do you love cheese and ice cream? Do you want to share your favorite? Do you make cheese or ice cream or frozen custard? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our conversation with self-proclaimed cheese geek Jeannie Carpenter as we kick off National Dairy Month. And if Rob is through chewing his
cheese, yeah, which is a bad thing to do on the radio, probably, but we're doing it anyway. We are celebrating National Dairy Month, and we want to hear how you are going to celebrate National Dairy Month. Call now at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite kind of cheese, your favorite kind of Wisconsin cheese, and are you a cheesemaker yourself? Call in now, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers. Now we've got Kenneth on the line in Janesville. Kenneth, hi.
Hello. I'm going to be celebrating Dr. Babcock because his test proved if you had water added to your milk, and that was a big factor. I mean, Wisconsin was known for the purity of its milk and its cheese in the beginning, and built the whole university system, and that these farmers thought maybe these eggheads know something or can help us do something, and that built our whole university system.
Kenneth, thanks a lot for that. And Babcock getting the water out of the milk, apparently. Do you know that story?
Yeah. There's a great quote in a book by Ed Janis in America's Dairyland where he got this from an old-time farmer, and it says, the Babcock test was better than the Bible in keeping farmers honest. And I've always thought that was kind of interesting. You know, there's always one bad apple in the bunch, and it kind of spoils it for everybody. But Kenneth was exactly right. Once that Babcock test started recording butterfat, the folks adding water were caught.
Well, thanks a lot for that, Kenneth. Interesting story there. And Jeannie, you brought along two cheeses. We talked about one, and the second is a cheddar.
Yeah,
tell us about the cheddar.
Yeah. So of the 129 cheese plants in Wisconsin, 92 of them make cheddar, right?
Wow.
Right? So that's a lot of cheddar. One of the trends that we've seen cheesemakers doing is aging their cheddar, because aged cheddar tends to be more complex, has some more of those, you know, those pop rock crystals, those calcium lactate crystals in it. Consumers really enjoy those. And the one I brought today is even a little bit different. This is a 5-year aged cheddar from Red Barn Family Farms. And this is a group of 4 farms in the Appleton area who have banded together, and they ship their milk to Springside Cheese in Okano Falls and have Wayne and Nathan Hintz there make cheese for them, and then they market it themselves. And that's kind of another trend we're seeing is farmers grouping together, cooperating together, producing really high quality milk under a certain standard of rules, and then making cheese for themselves, kind of dictating their own future of prices.
So do they make the cheese on premises, like the cheese is made off site, where they're sort of contracting out with
right,
someone else to
exactly,
make the cheese.
Yep.
So these partnerships in cheese making.
Right, exactly. Yep, they're partnering with a licensed cheesemaker so that these farmers don't have to build an on farm creamery. They're doing what they do best, which is raising cows and milking cows, and then they're partnering with a cheesemaker who does what he does best, making cheese.
Right, and that's and what brand did you say that was?
This is Red Barn Family Farms, and this is their new 5-year. At Metcalf's, we've always carried the 1 and 3 year, and the 5-year just came out this month, and it is spectacular.
It's pretty tasty. Are people liking the sharper cheddars these days?
Yes. And this one is cool too because it's made in a wheel, the old-fashioned daisy wheel form. It's wrapped in linen and then dipped in wax. And so there's something magical about that linen and wax combination that lets the cheese breathe as it ages, and it just develops this more complex, nutty flavor.
I'm going to get back to the calls, but I have to ask, is that what's called bandage when we talk about bandage cheese?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
There's more and more folks making a bandage cheddar, and it's wrapping those curds in linen.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Juice on the line in West Alice. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering about the types of bacteria that you use in the making of the cheese and what they do for the flavor.
Okay, bacteria and cheese.
Sure. Yeah, so bacteria is also called starter culture. So if you've ever read the ingredients on your cheese package, it says usually four things. It says milk, bacteria, enzymes, and salt. At its face, cheese seems like a pretty simple product, right? But the starter culture or the bacteria is what determines the flavor of the cheese, what style of cheese it becomes. There are millions of types of starter cultures. So there are starter cultures for Swiss cheese. There are starter cultures for cheddar cheese. There are starter cultures for Gouda cheese. And there are actually what are called culture houses that sell these cultures. Cheesemakers buy them over the internet. They're shipped. They are measured very, very carefully and then added to the milk in the vat. And that is the very first process in cheesemaking.
Well, so those aren't made in-house in Wisconsin, those cultures.
Oh, gosh, no. Those are all coming, most of them are coming from Europe.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, Jeannie Carpenter is with us now, specialty cheese buyer for Metcalf's Market and the founder of Wisconsin Cheese Originals, as we talk about the start of National Dairy Month and the prominence of dairy and cheese here in Wisconsin. And another caller here, Alex, is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Alex.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Hey, I had a question about the, I heard that there's a report that we have like excess cheese in the market, and I wanted to know, what's it doing to the farmers? Is there concern for it? Does it drive down stock of cheese? If they do have stock in cheese, you know, are they producing less?
Got it, Alex. Yeah, we've been talking, we've been hearing about this as Alex brings up the cheese glut. Is there too much, is there such a thing as too much cheese? Apparently there is, because we've been hearing this term, Alex, use cheese
so,
glut.
So I'm so glad that someone called in with this question. So I'm going to defer to John Umhafers, who is the executive director of the Wisconsin Cheesemakers Association. He wrote a really excellent column on this subject about 3 weeks ago in the Cheese Market News. And what John pointed out is that the original media report that launched all these headlines that we see of a cheese glut was actually centered around one very obscure statistical fact. That fact is cold storage data for cheese. So the article compared March data year over year and found stocks at an all-time high, and then jumped to the very interesting conclusion that there was too much cheese in America. So we have to remember that America has made more cheese every year for the last 20 years. People are eating more cheese. So it's not going to be surprising that warehouse stocks are trending upward. I think what the missed story is right now is that we have really booming worldwide milk production and cheese production. And as a result, prices to pay to dairy farmers and cheesemakers are becoming a little depressed. Everything is cyclical. Things go up and down. Right now, we're in one of those down cycles. So we have a lot of farmers and cheesemakers kind of hanging on until we get to that cycle going upward.
And Jeannie, we're running short of time here, but we have a caller who we're not going to have time for, but wants to know whether there's still caraway cheese around. Do you still buy caraway cheese?
Yeah, there's Havarti with caraway. That's pretty common, both Danish and Wisconsin. And caraway seems to be one of those old-time flavors that people really like. They remember when they were little. It's gone out of fashion a little bit, but you can still find it.
And in our last minute here, can you tell us about cheese's significance in Wisconsin as a culture?
Oh, my gosh. So there's this thing that we wear on our heads at Packer games, right, called the cheese head. And I think, you know, that started out maybe as kind of a slam against Wisconsin, but we've sort of really taken it on our own. And so the next time that you see one of those cheese heads, what I want you to remember is that it really represents Wisconsin makes more specialty cheese than any other state in the nation. Dairy means more to Wisconsin than citrus to Florida or potatoes to Idaho. And it's like a $43 billion industry in the state. So that's what those little foam cheese heads represent.
Jeannie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is Jeannie Carpenter, specialty cheese buyer for Metcalf's Market, and she's the cheese buyer and also founder of Wisconsin Cheese Originals. You can tell us what your favorite cheese is. You can stop on over to the Central Time Facebook page and let us know. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Been been talking about spelling a lot lately. We asked you yesterday to share your most common misspelled words. Everybody's got one. I've got mine. You've got yours. And a lot of our listeners had them.
And here's one thing they have in common. A lot of them turn out to be French. Both of yours yesterday, Rob, were French, Mediterranean,
entrepreneur.
Yep. And then a Dick from Facebook said his is bourgeoisie.
Bourgeoisie. Very French sound, very French word. And Kelly, liaison.
Liaison.
So maybe it'll help us spell it if we say it with an overdone French accent.
Like Judas Sears Poisson, our executive producer.
Liaison.
Liaison.
Bourgeoisie. You've been sharing more on the Central Line Facebook page, more misspellings. Adam had a necessarily. I don't think that's so French, but that's one of those ones. Do the letters change when it goes from necessary to necessarily?
Well, that's one where which consonants do you double? You know there's doubles
right.
in there, but which ones are they? And then you can trip yourself up so many different ways. Figure out which is which.
And then Jonah had one. It's that I before E thing. Receipt. He wants to go R-E-C-I-E-P-T. The E and the I should be flipped around. The thing I learned yesterday is I shouldn't be judgmental about people's spelling. And then I thought, do you drop the E in judgmental or don't you? I don't know. I'll have to look it up later.
I think we're all kinder, better people today because everyone misspells stuff.
All thanks to Central Time, spelled however you like.